Hello, I am Soldanela, and this is Notes from a Native Daughter. My guest today is a multi-talented, tenacious artist, a creative soul who is a filmmaker, a media professional, a political activist. She says that she's a former salsa dancer, but I think she's still a salsa dancer. At heart, definitely, and at parties, without a doubt. Also of note is that Melissa is one of the core committee members of Las 35 Mujeres en Nueva York por la Liberación de Oscar López Rivera. And I've seen Melissa grow professionally in the last, I want to say, 6, 7, 8 years. And she has a very special project honoring Isabelita Rosado that we're going to talk about. So this is Melissa Montero. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's definitely an honor, and I'm excited to speak with you. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. So let's talk right now. Let's kind of like do a little, you know, overview of things. I'm interested, whenever I see and learn that someone was a dancer, I want to know where that dancing life came from. Because I was a dancer, and you know, I'm still a dancer in my soul and my heart. So tell me a bit about that.
Okay. I always loved dancing as a child. I always wanted my parents to put me in tap. But, you know, they weren't around a lot. They worked full time. My father was a small business owner. So he had 2 businesses. And then my mom, you know, worked as a secretary. And then on the weekends, she would work at my father's, you know, at their business together. So I got into sports because it was at school, it was available, and it was easy to get there. I didn't start really dancing. I mean, and I danced, you know, obviously growing up with my parents, the way you dance salsa at home and all of that. But I didn't start like dancing on stage until I was in high school. And that's when I started to do contemporary and modern because there was a dance program at the high school I went to in Queens. And then after that, I just like started choreographing in high school. And then in college, I minored in dance.
You did?
Then, yeah. Yeah, so that was fun. And I always found a way to be on stage. So, you know, I was performing from like the age of 14 all the way until I was 29.
That's funny. And you know, we have that in common, and I didn't know that. I mean, I majored in dance, but I didn't know that about you. That's fascinating.
Yeah, thank you. It was a huge dancing was a huge part of my life for a really long time. And you know, when I decided to stop performing, mm-hmm. I mean, I still do it for fun and all of that. But when I decided to stop, it was a real hard decision. You know, I always say, like, you know, I compare it to a boyfriend. It's like that boyfriend you never get over, mm-hmm. and you're still trying to deal with the breakup. So that's how I feel.
It's very romantic.
Yeah, that's how I feel about salsa and dancing. So I never quite got over it. So now I take classes for fun, and I started to do some hustling. So that's kind of like where I feel like my heart is right now. So
really, the hustle, like 70s
I
disco.
Love it.
Yep. Me too. Where? We got to talk about this off the record because I need to know, because I also love the hustle. I do it, not because I know it, but I do it because I can dance, you know, because I got, mm-hmm. you know, and I can just do it. But I think it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is. It's fun. I find it just as fun as salsa and cha-cha-cha and all of that.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's definitely great.
So now I understand something about you that makes sense, because I don't know about you, but in my experience, dancers, even former quote-unquote dancers, are some of the most tenacious and committed people.
Aww.
Don't you think? Yeah. I mean, dancers, like, I mean, I danced since I was like 4, and I'm 40, I'm about to be 46. And one of the things that was always that I think continues to be true for me was that at a very early age when I started to dance and started really getting into it, was the discipline of, like, you can never be late to class.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you just have to go to class and you have to be there early. And that has kept true throughout my adult life and my life outside of the dance realm. Is that true for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was, since I didn't start dance, I did sports when I was in elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when I was in high school, like the whole commitment part really became real for me, because I always felt like I didn't have a normal, like, high school experience, mm-hmm, as some of the other kids that I went to school with, because I never, you know, was able to get out of class and hang out with my friends. It was always like class finished and I went to dance.
Right.
You know, and it was always like, and then I would stay in school till really late. So it was definitely like I learned the sense of commitment at a young age. And even when I was, when I started dancing in my 20s for the dance company that I was in, that was it. And I felt sometimes that people didn't understand that commitment. And sometimes my family didn't understand that, but it was more or less like I knew that this is where I wanted to be for a very long time.
Hmm.
And, you know, you just, it's not like we got paid crazy amount of money, especially in the salsa world, but it was just this commitment and everybody was on the same page. So it didn't matter,
right,
you know, that you had to miss evenings going out and got home late and all of this stuff. But the commitment was there for a long time for me. So,
yeah, it's the love.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Definitely. And so, I mean, yeah, that's interesting. So you're an Ecuadorian and Puerto Rican hybrid.
Yes.
Child.
Yes.
How does that play out in your life? In your identity? And how do you formulate yourself within that? It's really beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I pretty much grew up in a household where I feel like our Puerto Rican heritage was emphasized a bit more,
mm-hmm,
even by my own father.
Mm-hmm.
And as proud as he is as being Ecuadorian, he, you know, our family that we were very connected to was my family in Puerto Rico. And so he always felt, even as a form of safety too, like back in the day in Puerto Rico, especially where my family's from, San Germán,
mm-hmm,
he just always felt it was so much safer for us to be there than to be where, you know, he was from in Guayaquil.
Okay.
And so that was always like his reason. And I'm sure it was because, you know, flights to South America are definitely more, but we were connected. You know, my mom has three other sisters. My father, you know, only had one sibling. And he died when I was a teenager. And so my mom was very close to her sisters. My father's parents passed away. So I didn't really have, you know, my experience of my Ecuadorian grandparents. It was always, you know, my grandparents in Puerto Rico. And that's how we grew up, always going there. So, you know, and he loved Puerto Rico very much too. So for him, it wasn't like a problem.
Right.
And so it was, you know, it was definitely an interesting childhood, because they sent us to Puerto Rico every single summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were able to live there for a very short time when I was a toddler. So,
but you grew up in Queens.
Yeah. Yeah. Grew up in Queens. And, my mother came to New York when she was 10. In 1956. So, you know, she's a New Yorker too. And
mm-hmm,
she came here. All my family came between the 30s and the 50s to New York. And then by 1971, all of my mother's family moved back to Puerto Rico. And my mother was the only one that stayed and the only one that, you know, married an Ecuadorian. So.
And then had a family.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And how was it for you? I mean, growing up in this, was it a bilingual household in a sense?
Yeah, I mean, we spoke Spanish a lot.
Because I know you understand perfect Spanish.
Yeah. And I speak it too. I mean, my father came here very young also. Mm-hmm. He came in the 60s, but he primarily speaks Spanish more. And so my mom always, even till now, just... And even most of my mother's friends also, were more of Spanish-speaking friends. Even her friends that moved here from Puerto Rico, they just kind of stayed, just always talking Spanish. So we did that. My father, you know, my parents were very proud. They always wanted us to talk Spanish. Even my sister and my brother had tutors because my mother wanted to perfect the Spanish with them. But then when I came along, you know, that ended. So, but yeah, they had tutors and everything. And then when we went to move to Puerto Rico, I was 2. But we came back when I was 5. And so my sister and my brother were able to go to school out there for a little while. But I didn't have that. But yeah.
And so how do you then go from, I guess, you know, how does your love and intensity for activism begin?
Okay. I always feel like there's a lot of factors. Sometimes I sit back and I look at, well, you know, how did I get involved and, or how, you know, how did that love come out of my heart? I always feel like I even now I know I'm an intense person, and as a child I knew I was very intense as well. I always wanted to know a lot of things. I loved history as a kid. I always remember, like, I think like it was 4th or 5th grade that love of history really came out for me. And so I kind of always held on to that and always wanted to learn about things and why things happened. And so I think it was in high school that I had taken this class. It was an elective. We didn't have to take it, but I wanted to, and it was on contemporary history. And in that class, I was introduced into a lot of social movements, like the Black Liberation Movement, the Women's Movement, you know, a lot of different, you know, obviously they didn't talk about the Young Lords, which is something else, but, you know, I got exposed to that, and so by the time I went to college, I kind of started to formulate these ideas. And then when I was in college, I met other people, other young people that, you know, thought differently. And I was like, wow, I want to be around these people because they're teaching me. And there were young people my age as well. And one day, this young Dominican sister I'm still friends with, she tells me she was in this program, and the program that she was in, it was for college students of color. And so, and that they, how do I explain? They were, you know, let me go back to it. They gave them this form of curriculum that was like geared towards empowering students of color. And so she knew about Los Nacionalistas and Don Pedro and all this, and she comes and starts to talk to me about it, and I'm like, oh, I don't know this, you know. And then she's like, and you're Puerto Rican? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, damn, I'm like, I'm ashamed that I don't know any of this stuff. And so, like, I started to read more on this, and then the people I went to college with, I met, you know, Tato, right? Mm-hmm. Tato Torres. I went to school with his
Carlos
sister.
Javier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, you said Carlos Tato Torres, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry.
It's an inside. But yes, he's a good friend. I love him very much.
Tato is like a mentor to me. So I went to school with his sister that, may she rest in peace, Lisa. And Lisa and I became good friends. And so she introduced me to him, to Tato, because she knew, you know, I wanted to learn more about Puerto Rican history and that, and I was reading stuff on my own. And so I met him, and then I just started to meet other people in the community. You know, I met another good friend of mine who worked for the Justice Committee, and she told me about Richie Perez, and then I met Panama, and then I met Espy, and I started to meet all of these people, and I was like, wow, you know, there's this history that I didn't know. And so I remember that things from my childhood kind of started to come back, mm-hmm. you know, and I remember there was an incident with my grandfather when I was, I think like in high school. And I used to always compare Puerto Rico and Ecuador, you know, like if it was apples to apples, but to me it was just like, you know, they're both two countries, but one belongs to the U.S. and one doesn't. And I remember I used to ask questions. I used to ask my father, and I'm like, but Papi, why isn't Ecuador a territory of the U.S.? Why is Puerto Rico? And he would try to explain to me, because I always wanted to just see the differences, and like I would compare them. And then I remember asking my grandfather, and he flipped out on me. And he was like, yo no quiero nacionalista en mi casa. And I'm like, what is he talking about? And I was in high school, and I had no idea what a nationalist was. I had no idea what any of this was. And so when I started to learn all this stuff, I was just like, wow, that's what my grandfather's talking about. Now I know what he means, you know? And then I just started to put things together. I started to see how my grandfather, you know, would react to certain political figures he saw on TV, and how growing up, my sister, a lot of my sisters and my brother's friends were, their families were Penepe. And I never knew when my grandfather hated them, you know? And, but my grandfather was a diehard Popular. And so he disliked everybody else but Populares. And so all these things started to come together. The more I read, and I'm like, now I know why, you know, some of my family members think this way, or why my grandfather. It really gave me an insight to my grandfather and his generation and how he looked at the world.
And Luis Muñoz Marín was the second Messiah.
Yeah, yeah. To him, he loved him. That was, you know, the person he followed. And I remember always seeing the symbol for the Populares in his, my grandfather was a carpenter, so he used to have that up.
Pan, tierra y libertad.
Y libertad.
Yeah, I recall, this is not that long ago, I want to say maybe like 10 years ago. And for some reason it struck me, but it was the first time that I kind of like, wait a minute. I went home for Christmas, and my mother, my grandmother, my aunt, they all lived together for many, many years. And one afternoon, I think I came from the airport. It was like sort of random like that. And I go by my aunt's room, who I adore, by the way, Alicia Titicali. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that on her, like, above her, like, dresser, she had a picture of Jesus Christ and Luis Muñoz Marín.
Right there.
And I was like, oh, my God, that's so classic. I should have taken a picture.
Yeah, her two favorite men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I kind of started to mention it in conversations where people were talking about, you know, familias puertorriqueñas y eso. And it wasn't odd. It was like, ah, sí, no, en mi casa también. I was like, oh, really?
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
know? Yeah. So, God, fast forward to now.
Mm-hmm.
And so should we talk about Isabelita first?
Yeah, I mean, if you wanna talk about her first or whatever.
Well, it's just, it's more in the order of your...
Of my life?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Because they're both related to this sort of journey that you went into.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and so now you're an advocate for La Liberación de Oscar López Rivera, which, of course, it's like an oxymoron. Yes, we want him free. But you also you've been working on this documentary for a long time.
Yes.
And it's gotten all these, you know...
Grants.
Well, I wanted to say not only grants, but also versions.
Yeah, yeah. It's finally come into the piece that I think fits the most, and kind of, and really just explains why I even went on this journey. So I met Isabel at 23 years old, right when I graduated college, a few months after, I believe. And meeting her was part of this like really interesting journey, because I was at this point where I was just reading all of this stuff and all, you know, all these things on Don Pedro and just the history. And so meeting her was kind of like, wow, a blast from the past, and I'm seeing living history right here, you know? And that for me was like such a turning point in my life. But I also at the same time didn't realize that meeting her was like as significant as I see it today. And I also didn't realize that going, you know, meeting her and going on this journey of, I guess you could say, searching for a deeper sense of my identity and my culture, I didn't realize it was that in that moment. You know, I just saw it as like history and like I was, you know, a political activist and meeting, you know, my hero, but it was really more searching for like a part of me. And so it was interesting. I mean, when I first met her, I right away I was just like, wow, she's amazing because she treats you so important. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the first time that you meet and she genuinely wants to know about you and your life. And that's how she made me feel right away. Like it didn't, you know, I've interviewed a few people in my life,
mm-hmm.
and a few women, and, you know, it always kind of felt like I was, and I want to say just women, like just, you know, it could be men and women, but kind of like, okay, I'm the younger one and I need them more than they need me. That's not how Isabel made me feel. You know, she really treated me as her equal and important, and as a young person, that my life mattered just as much. And so I think that's really what drew me in also, you know, and then I started to see her as like a grandmother figure or a godmother. And then just as our friendship grew, just even when she saw me, how she would react toward me,
mm-hmm.
and how she always, you know, started to treat me as a, you know, in a way as a part of the family, even not even just her, but also her primary caretaker, which was her, I don't want to say her caretaker, maybe her tutor, her nephew,
mm-hmm.
Radames. And so he started to treat me as like someone in the family. You know, if Doña Isabel wasn't doing well, he would call me. Things like that. I made sure that I stayed in touch with her as much as I could. I called her pretty often. You know, I just found her very special. I find a lot of elders special, and I think that comes from just spending a lot of time with my grandparents.
Yeah. Well, aside from her, you meeting her as an elder, I mean, she's also una luchadora.
Of course.
And that spirit never left her, obviously.
Yeah, no, it didn't. I mean, she had the same convictions that she had when she joined the Nationalist Party at 30 years old.
Mm-hmm. So for, you know, for the sake of our audiences,
mm-hmm.
Yours and mine, when they see that it's you, and the people that don't know her, why don't you briefly give a synopsis of her, since you are the creator mm-hmm. of this documentary that I've seen from the beginning. Do you remember when you first came to the house, my house?
Yes. Yeah,
did you get to see the painting that I have of her?
Is that the one that
Pablo made of her?
Yes, I remember.
It's this beautiful painting that I have. I mean, it features prominently in my living room.
Yeah.
It is of her, like, holding a balance, like, like in front of a, like, she's in the water, and it's, like, her breasts as if she were carrying a baby almost.
Yeah. Somebody else has that painting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's several of them. It's beautiful.
Copies, yeah. When I interviewed Carlos Galliza, he had it in his house. And I was like, oh my God, I saw this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you interviewed the legendary Carlos Galliza también.
Yeah, I got to interview him. And he was great too. Really, really nice. And good to talk to. See, I learned so much. You know, sometimes I go back to that interview, feel like I forget something. Sometimes I go back to my interviews, to the transcripts, if I'm, you know, trying to remember a detail about something that happened in Puerto Rico. I'm like, I have this in a transcript. Let me look it up. But about Isabel, right?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I talk about her. Where Isabel, you know, is from Ceiba, Puerto Rico, and she was born in 1907. And she's one of eight siblings. And so she came from a very big family. You know, her father was a farmer, and he had his own land, and, you know, her mom helped very much with cultivating the land, but her father also worked for sugar plantations during the harvest. She had a different, I would say, opportunity than a lot of women at her time. Her father was very, her parents, I would say, were very progressive, because they always felt that, you know, women should also receive the same education as men, and they always pushed her to go to school. And she didn't start school till a little late in her childhood because she was very sick as a child. But she went all the way, you know, she went to college, she studied at the UPR. And so I believe she first started as a rural teacher and then moved on to be a social worker. And, you know, when I think about social work and her life and talking to other social workers, I see like why she would become a social worker. And it's because, you know, she wanted to be of service to her community and to her people. And I feel like sometimes that's like an extension of social movements and, you know, things like that. But, and her father also believed in Puerto Rican independence. And so she kind of had all of these different ideals. And then, so when the Masacre de Ponce happened, where, over two dozen people were killed, I believe, and over 200 injured,
she
that
took
changed
on,
her life.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. It changed her life, and she decided to join Don Pedro and his cause.
And the rest, she became a national hero. So yep. Now, when I saw you last at La Marqueta,
yes,
you told me that now the dock is going to be a short dock.
Yeah, I mean, I'm playing with different ideas. One is to maybe create a very powerful 30 minutes and then kind of release webisodes online.
That's a good idea.
Find another way. Yeah, find another way of like getting it out to other audiences online, because I feel like now that's what a lot of people are doing. And, you know, so that's an idea I'm working with. But, you know, the film does include my story in terms of looking closer at my heritage and how all of that brought me to Doña Isabelita. And of course her life. But yeah, I mean, she had an incredible life, and not just because, you know, she dedicated her life to something and never gave up, but also because she just lived so powerfully. You know, everything that she did, she did it, whatever it was, you know, she did it with love and conviction, and was always very clear, very sure about herself, and very confident. And that's one thing that I took away. She was very such a confident person.
Confidence.
Yeah, confident and very had like strength of in her mind, like strength of mind. You know, I don't know how to explain that, but I always found her to be very strong mentally.
Well, she lasted over 100 years old. She must have been.
Yeah. 107.
107. Qué bella.
Yeah.
I guess this may be silly, but did it influence you in your resolve to get this project done somehow?
Oh, I mean, I felt that way. I remember when she passed away, I felt like, I can't believe this film is not done. And I'm like, when I think about it, I feel like that now. You know, it's the film is basically shot. I just have to edit the film. I was actually meeting with my editor today, and that's something we're discussing, seeing what the options are to be able to work on this without having the funding right now. And so he pretty much agreed that we're going to just continue cutting. We have to figure out a schedule, but that, you know, he's committed, and we actually had that conversation today. So I'm really happy that he's available, you know, probably in a few weeks or maybe at the beginning of the new year to continue working on this until the rest of the money is, until I guess you could say deferred.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For now, and so that was really touching because he's really committed to it. But yeah, I mean, I have bits and pieces and scenes that are edited that are, you know, really touching and nice, and I would love to share that with people.
So it's definitely a good time.
Thank you.
I mean, with everything that's going on, not only in the world, but obviously in our island and la diaspora y la identidad. And so what about Oscar López Rivera? How do you arrive to be one of the leaders to advocate for his freedom here in the city?
Yeah. So when I was in my early 20s and I was meeting all of these people that I found very fascinating and that I admired, that's when I started to learn about, it was around the time of the Vieques, what was happening in Vieques, so I started to learn about all of these different Puerto Rican political prisoners and I didn't even know they existed, and so I started to get involved with different organizations, and then for me, that just felt like the cause within, you know, Puerto Rican independence and other different movements that just kind of latched onto my heart a little stronger than other ones.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was involved with Carlos Alberto's campaign in New York, but... So yeah, that was really how I got involved, and then obviously, you know, led me to Oscar. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely been an interesting journey, and when we became the 35 Mujeres, or not, but when we formed the 35 Mujeres in New York, it was a few years ago. So technically, it was 32 or 33 Mujeres. New York City for Oscar, and that was formed because I learned about what the women in Puerto Rico were doing, and so mm-hmm. they came to New York, and they wanted women in New York to form a group, and so I said, I'm going to take this on, and I decided to involve a few other women that I know would be committed, so I reached out to like a key 3-4 other women that I know would be committed from beginning to end, or, you know, no matter what. And they are till today. They're also core committee members. And you know, this is something that's just become a part of our lives. Like, we know we're going to go out and protest every single month.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been able to get other women to join us. And we really do it in solidarity with the women in Puerto Rico and in solidarity with Oscar. So that's why we wanted to do it the same exact day and same exact time as the women in Puerto Rico.
Qué linda. Yeah.
Thank you.
Do you feel you feel strong? Do you feel free? Do you feel you're living your dream?
I feel strong. So I feel free. I feel free, I guess you could say, to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But not free in the sense of, you know, I think about political prisoners in general and Oscar, and I just feel like, you know, as long as they're behind
bars,
then, you know, a part of us isn't free. So that's how I kind of see it. And in terms of my dreams, I feel like I have fulfilled only some of my dreams. I still feel like I have a huge list of other dreams that I want to fulfill that include, you know, wanting to move back to Puerto Rico and kind of jumping in more into like possibly arts management or curating art or, you know, just jumping into other areas of art. So, you know, I think about a lot of different things that I want to do. I think I want to do too much, you know, oh, I want to do this, I want to do that, but...
That's a good attitude to have.
Oh, thank you.
Because don't you think that if you were to say, well, yeah, I've done everything, it's like, you have? Really?
Not at all. I'm just like, oh, there's a huge list. And I want to dance again on stage. So that's something else that's on my mind. So I started taking some classes again, and I'm going to do a really great workshop in like 2 weeks with Maria Torres. So that sounds pretty exciting for me.
Yeah, she's great.
And so I want to do some of that a little bit more. I would love to be on stage again. So yeah.
All right. Well, I admire you. I'm proud of you.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing Isabelita Rosado, the documentary, short documentary, whichever version. I think I've seen all the versions pretty much completed and done.
Oh my God.
So we can share it because, you know, she's an inspiration, definitely. And, you know, I want to age like her. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
With that fortitude and what you said, I you know, the strong mind is, it's definitely something that we all need to exist in this really crazy world. But I...
Just one thing that, I'm sorry, I don't mean...
No, go ahead.
Isabelita used to say...
the perfect ending, please say. What did she say?
She used to say, mientras menos cosas, mejor. Talking about materialistic things. And that always kind of stayed with me because I feel like that's how she lived her life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she didn't worry about all of these material things, and she didn't worry about, I feel like, trivial things, you know, and she always had that mindset, mientras menos cosas mejor. And I was just always stayed with me. She used to say that. And I was like, wow, you know, and
it's profound.
She was happy, yeah. She was always, always, always happy, no matter if she was sad, you know. I think she always wanted to overcome any sadness she ever felt with happiness, and so.
Ay, Dios. All right. So, mientras menos cosas, mejor.
Mm-hmm.
That bleeds into a lot of things.
Yeah.
All right. Well, gracias.
Thank you. Thank you. It was definitely an honor to speak with you.
Likewise.
All right.